We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bojovics. Joining me today is Paul Bellinger. He started the YouTube channel in 2013 called Bellinge P to share some of his theories that he learned that were true, as well as to highlight the flaws in the theories that he found to be false. The channel was recently renamed Evidence-Based Wealth, and he retired at 50. Thanks for joining me today, Paul.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be here, Tom.
So why don't we start by getting a little bit of your background and, you know, really go into a little bit about how you or what led you to start your channel, Paul?
Okay. Well, I'm a chemical engineer by training. I got my undergraduate at Villanova University, and I earned a PhD at Lehigh University. And then I went on to work for an employer, in New Jersey for a little while. But as I started, I got very interested in investing because I realized that all of us are going to ultimately be responsible for our financial well-being. And so I did a deep dive, and I started out with value investing because it made the most sense to me. So works of Benjamin Graham, Warren Buffett, biographies of Warren Buffett. He doesn't write too much himself other than his annual investor meeting notes. And one thing that caught my attention in 1997 was that Buffett made a very large purchase of silver. And so my antennas went up and I thought, oh, wow, this is really interesting. This is a big diversion for him. What does he know? And so I started studying silver. And I found a lot of things that were compelling about the message of investing in silver. So I started, accumulating silver. And this was during the initial portions of my working career as a chemical engineer. This got me more and more interested in monetary science. And so I studied avariciously over the next decade to the point where I almost felt like I got another degree in economics, and one that really doesn't agree 100% with the mainstream, world of finance. But I learned a lot of things that I thought were true. And so I launched my channel in 2013. So over the past decade, I've been putting out a lot of videos. I think there are a few hundred up on the site at this point. I very much enjoy having interactions with my subscribers in the conversation section. They learn from me, I learn from them. So I have a very good community on YouTube. Now, in the meantime, while producing those videos, I refined my approach to financial independence and built my financial independence, my golden tickets of sorts, to the point where I was ready to retire a couple of years ago. Now, it just so happens that a couple of years ago, the firm I was working for merged with another company. And so the politics got very bad. The level of bureaucracy got very bad and people were treated very poorly. And so I decided just this year that this was going to be when I leave, mainstream corporate America, enjoy my financial independence and, earn a supplemental income producing information for others in written format. And so I launched Evidence-Based Wealth as a Patreon.
Paul, I love, going through your channel, you provide a very analytical view on everything. You, whatever subject you're breaking down, and really try to analyze it from every possible side and break it down just using, math, basically. And you really need to provide evidence for yourself, right? So one of the things I wanted to discuss with you today is whether you think we're on a type of gold standard of sorts.
Yeah, it's a great question, Tom. And this is one of the things that I think sets my channel apart from many of the other gold and silver channels that are out there. And I think it's probably a message that might upset a lot of people, because I think a lot of people are invested in the fact that we don't have a gold standard. But in my view, there are the things that we're allowed to see and the things that we're really not permitted to see. And the things that we're not permitted to see, we can kind of piece them together from trails of evidence that are available out there. So let me just walk us through this real quick. Before 1934, we were on a gold standard. Actually, before 1873, we were actually on a silver standard or a bimetallic standard. But the change in the coinage act put us on a strict gold standard. But anyway, in the early 1930s, we had the banking panic, and that resulted in FDR issuing an executive order, which called in the gold, mostly from the Federal Reserve banks, and put it into Treasury custody. Now, when that happened, what happened was that the Federal Reserve banks were credited with what are called gold certificates. Now, these gold certificates are, in fact, liens on Treasury gold. And what I mean by a lien is similar to what you have, what the bank owns as a result of giving you a mortgage on your house. So if you don't pay your mortgage, the lien essentially says that the bank can, foreclose on your house. Now, the lien itself is not exercisable unless you are in default. And the same is true for the gold certificates. They cannot be exercised at the discretion of the Federal Reserve. Okay, they can only be exercised at the discretion of the Secretary of the Treasury. But regardless, they do have value because they do encumber the gold that's in the U.S. Treasury. Now, after 1934, we were on the Bretton Woods system, which a lot of people also view as a gold standard because, the money was still defined as a certain amount of gold backing each Federal Reserve note. And in the 1960s, as Johnson was exercising his guns and butter programs, what we saw was that, the Treasury gold was being drained. And France in particular was leading the charge. And we were getting to a point where it looked like we were going to be completely drained of gold. And so Nixon, in August of 1971, issued an executive order and closed the gold window. So he stopped the convertibility of the foreign held Federal Reserve notes for gold. Now, where does that leave us? Where that leaves us is that we still have these gold certificates sitting on the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve. And they do have value and they do encumber the gold. And I'd like to go through a couple of slides to basically make it clear why I think that we are still on a gold standard. So I'm going to share my screen right now. Okay.
So this shows how you really care about the currency in circulation, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, this makes a particular point that will lead into that. So right here, what we can see is a screenshot taken from the Federal Reserve System of the amount of different denominations of U.S. currency that are in circulation. Okay, so one thing that you need to know is that the currency in circulation is it's not created by the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve banks can request that physical currency be printed, but it's only the Bureau of Engraving and Printing of the U.S. Treasury that can actually print these notes. Okay, and the Federal Reserve needs to buy these notes from the Treasury out of accounts at the Federal Reserve. So it creates a liability on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. So here we're seeing 5 years. It only goes up to 2018 because when I made the video, that's the data that was available. And it shows, $1 notes, $2 notes, $5, $10, $20, $50, and $100. And you can see the totals here. Back in 2014, there was about $1.3 trillion worth of physical notes in existence. In 2018, there was about close to $1.7 trillion of U.S. notes in existence. This year, there's about $2.2 trillion worth of physical notes in existence. But one thing that you'll see, which is really interesting, is this column here that says $100. Now, how many times do you use a $100 bill to make transactions?
Pretty rarely.
Pretty rarely. Mm-hmm. Me too. I mean, I have used them in the past. I can count on one hand the number of times that I've actually either tendered or received a $100 note. Mm-hmm. But notice here, the amount of $100 notes that are in circulation compared to the total. This is a full 80% of the currency in circulation is $100 notes. So these actually don't move, right? I mean, they're not moving around. So the only conclusion that you can make is that 80% of the currency in circulation is being treated as a store of value. Now, why? It's got to be because people hold on to these, they hold on to them tightly. I know that Larry Summers back in, I think it was 2017, made the argument that we should do away with $100 notes because they're used in the drug trade. But I doubt that the drug lords would use $100 notes simply because, you know, they're very convenient. I mean, these things are a store of value. I'm convinced that they're spread all over Europe. They're spread all over Asia. They're spread all over Africa. These are being used as a store of value. So people know that they have worth, even though the Federal Reserve is constantly making new ones. Mm-hmm. Now let's go to another piece of evidence that I found on the US Treasury website. If you do a search on what are Federal Reserve notes and how are they different from United States notes, you'll find this on the US Treasury's website. They put this out as a Q&A, as part of a FAQ. I imagine if they start getting lots and lots of hits, they might take it down, but you know, for now it's there. I'm going to read one paragraph here. And it says, Congress has specified that a Federal Reserve Bank must hold collateral equal in value to the Federal Reserve notes that the bank receives. And if you go to the H4.1 report that the Federal Reserve publishes every week, you'll actually be able to see the gold certificates listed as collateral for these notes. So it says here, the collateral is chiefly gold certificates and United States securities. In other words, treasury bonds. This provides backing for the note issue. The idea was that if the Congress dissolved the Federal Reserve System, the United States would take over the notes, in other words, the liabilities. This would meet the requirements of Section 411, but the government would also take over the assets, which would be of equal value. Federal Reserve notes represent a first lien on all of the assets of the Federal Reserve banks and on collateral specifically held against them. So the first thing that should draw your attention is this mention of dissolving the Federal Reserve. So, you know, do you think that the Treasury would make such a statement lightly?
Absolutely not lightly, but I assume that, you know, there's probably parts of this that are maybe archaic, right? And not necessarily updated for how they to reflect how they want the system to run.
Yeah, it could very well be archaic, but this is a modern acknowledgement that it is a possibility.
Absolutely. Right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's always possible that if the Federal Reserve gets into a lot of trouble, the government could take them over, right? And so if they do take them over, what's going to happen? Well, they take over all the assets and all of the liabilities. Now, if most of the assets of the Federal Reserve are Treasury securities that back the liabilities, if the U.S. Treasury takes over the Federal Reserve, those Treasury notes, in a sense, they essentially vaporize. You cannot have an asset that's your own liability. So what does that leave? Well, it essentially leaves the gold certificates. So the Federal Reserve notes being one of the only liabilities of the Federal Reserve that is not Treasury securities, that those are the liabilities. The only asset really that's not the Treasury securities is the gold certificates. So essentially, the U.S. Treasury would take over the gold certificates, right? And what would be the liability against them, according to the Treasury, is the physical Federal Reserve notes, right? So one can only conclude from this that if there really was a crisis of confidence in the currency and the Treasury was, had no option other than to take over the Federal Reserve as a result of Congress dissolving the Federal Reserve, you can conclude that the value of those physical Federal Reserve notes would be one-to-one with the value of the gold held by the Treasury. Okay, so let's take a look at another chart that I like to show my viewers, and that is the ratio of currency in circulation to the marked-to-market value of the gold held by the Treasury. Now, the Treasury actually holds on its books gold valued at $42.22 per ounce. That's the statutory value of gold, but that's not its market value. So the market value is whatever the current spot price is, right? And the European Central Bank has taken a different approach to this than the Treasury. the European Central Bank periodically will mark to market the gold that's on its balance sheet. Let's take a look at this chart here for a minute. It starts in the year.
Yeah. Sorry, before we continue, do you know why that is, that the U.S. only values it at $42 still?
Well, that would require some speculation on my part.
Okay.
I believe one of the reasons is that if it were to revalue the gold, it would really call attention to the fact that gold is important. Mm-hmm. Right. Now, I mean, the European Central Bank has had these periodic central bank gold agreements where they acknowledge that gold is important to the financial system. But the U.S. really doesn't do that. I think part of the reason is that the U.S. has the luxury of issuing the world's reserve currency. And if it were to all of a sudden start talking about how important gold was, it would call that into question. Mm-hmm. So that's just speculation on my part. Okay. So going to the chart, if we start in 1971, you'll notice that the ratio of the currency in circulation at that time to the amount of gold that was held in the treasury. And I think that the gold at this time was a little bit more than 260 million ounces. I mean, it's 261.6 million ounces now. They had a little bit more back in 1971, but it's been largely consistent over the past five decades or so. So it started at about somewhere between 5 and 6. All right. So this corresponds to maybe 16% coverage. So let's see, if we were to take 5 here, that would mean we'd have a 20% coverage of currency in circulation by gold. So it was somewhat less than that. Mm-hmm. Now, over the ensuing decade, you'll notice that this ratio went down. And it went down and it hit the magic one number in 1980, which was the height of the 1970s currency crisis. So it was at this point where, if Congress actually did dissolve the Federal Reserve and take over all of its liabilities and assets, it could back the currency one-to-one with the gold that it had within its vaults. Okay. So I think that this is not just coincidence. You know, I think that if things had proceeded past 1980 the way that they had proceeded in the 1970s before Paul Volcker started jacking up interest rates, I believe that what would have happened would have been that the currency, this ratio probably would have stayed at about one, but the price of the gold would have continuously increased as the Federal Reserve requested more currency be printed by the Department of Engraving and Printing. Okay, so fast forward. Volcker basically broke the back of the inflation that was happening in the 1970s. He jacked up interest rates to the mid-teens, to the upper teens. And then we started seeing things turn around. So I think it was in 1982, the stock market started rebounding. The economy started getting healthier. Interest rates started coming down, the rate of inflation started coming down, and people got more and more confident. Okay. And as they got more confident, their trust in the US government to meet its obligations without, you know, currency printing increased. And you notice that the ratio increased and increased and increased until we got to a point where it was close to 9. Okay.
Paul, I just want to make a distinction here. This is physical currency in existence, right? Not deposits, correct?
This is physical currency in existence. The reason being is that the Treasury said that the physical Federal Reserve notes are the first lien against the assets. Okay. They didn't say anything about deposits. And I believe the reason for that is that the deposits are payable in the physical currency. Mm-hmm. So the deposits are basically just loans of the currency. It's the currency itself that has the lien against the gold.
And could you say in a way that the deposits are the digital representation of that currency?
Exactly. Deposits are the digital representation. Because of the fractional reserve system, there's obviously a lot more M2 than there is currency in circulation. Mm-hmm. And so there's a possibility that, you know, those loans just default, right? But the physical notes, they're going to be there.
Right.
Okay. So over time, you can see that this ratio increased to the point where it got pretty close to 9. So at this point in time, there were actually like 9 notes for every ounce in the treasury vaults, for 9 notes for every for what the market price of the gold said was there in the treasury. So in other words, if the Congress were to dissolve the Federal Reserve in 2001, then every owner of a physical Federal Reserve note would get basically 1/9 of what they would think that they'd be entitled to. Mm-hmm. And we all know what happened after 2001, right? The stock market started going haywire. We ended up with the financial crisis of 2008, 2009. And so the ratio started coming down as trust eroded in the ability of the U.S. government to fulfill its claims. Now, we reached a relative minimum in the year 2011. I believe it was late in the year 2011, where we were at about a 2.4 level. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then things started getting a little bit better and trust resumed a little bit. And right now we're hovering at a point of about 4.4. Okay. So right now, if Congress were to dissolve the Federal Reserve and take over, you know, all of its liabilities and all of its assets, it would have to basically devalue the currency by a little bit more than a factor of 4 in order to go on to a strict gold standard. Okay. Now, right in the middle of this chart is a line at 3.82. This just happens to be the average over the past 5 decades. And this can be used as a way to, you know, value the physical Federal Reserve notes. Now, I don't say value gold because personally, I think gold is the standard and it's the notes that are changing in value rather than vice versa. But we're always taught to look at the gold price. But, you know, you turn it on its head, you can derive the gold price from this, right? So right now, we're just a little bit over equilibrium. And so as things are, you know, going right now, confidence is a little bit higher than it has been on the average. And so the equilibrium value would have gold priced at a point that's maybe 25% higher than it is right now. Okay. That would bring it to $2,200 per ounce. However, if confidence is completely lost, I mean, if the Federal Reserve continues to request that the Treasury Bureau of Engraving and Printing print and print and print these notes, then as it stands right now, the price of gold would have to go to $8,350 per ounce in order to enable full backing of the currency. That gets a lot of people excited. People are a little bit less excited about $2,200 per ounce. But one thing that I'd like to point out is that over the past year, and this is after they said that main consequences of the pandemic were largely behind us, physical currency in circulation has increased by 11%. And as long as that continues, the equilibrium price of gold is going to go up by the relative amount that the currency in circulation is increasing. And at the moment, it's increasing by 11% per year. So when I look at this, I advise people, I say, you know, the price of gold is highly volatile, but take a look at bonds. I mean, you could buy a bond for 1 or 2% nominal interest rates in a time when 11% more currency is being printed every year. So in my mind, I'd rather take the gamble on owning the gold and dealing with the fluctuation in its price than in holding bonds and, you know, risking devaluation.
Absolutely. And you have so many, you know, videos on your channel, Paul, that really highlight the importance of gold. Is there anything else you want to go through on this one? Any other slides before we move on?
No, not on this topic, unless you have any other questions.
Nope, that's it. You kind of covered that in, let's say, what that convertibility would be if we wanted to convert those notes to gold. So obviously that would make the price of gold either way valued much higher, right?
I believe so. So unless currency, unless confidence continues to increase in the U.S., in which case the price of gold could go down, but I kind of doubt that.
And these spikes, the low points, sorry, on the chart are also associated with high points in the gold price, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So you've created another video that highlights the importance of owning gold by creating a probability game of sorts. So what does this game highlight for us?
Okay, I produced a video a while back. I think it was in 2014, called Probability Blindness in a World of Red and Green. And basically what it discusses is the fact that we really don't have a good appreciation for the rare event, right? Most people learn by watching history and seeing what happens in front of them. And they put together these mental models for what they think should happen. And this is one of the reasons that's usually given for not owning gold, because most people see gold as a fallow asset, not producing an income like stocks and bonds. And because stocks and bonds have performed so well over time, they say, well, you know, why not just own the stocks and bonds? If everything goes to hell, you know, you're not going to want to have the gold anyway. It's not going to be any good to you, right? So in the fashion of Nassim Taleb, who does a much better job at explaining these rare events than I do, I put together this little game to illustrate basically the main lesson. So let's play that game now, okay? I'm going to put a vat of marbles in front of you, okay? And you can't see the marbles, but I'm going to tell you, okay, there's a lot of green marbles in here and a lot of red marbles in here. I'm not going to tell you the relative proportion of each. I'm just going to say, hey, they're there. And you have a starting score of 100. So let's call that $100, right? Now, if I pull a green marble out of the vat and you're playing, your wealth is going to increase by a certain amount. If I pull a red marble out of the vat and you're playing, you're going to lose a certain amount of your wealth. But if you sit in the parking lot, that's essentially all of your wealth is off the table. Okay, it's safe. You know, you're not going to be subject to the game. You can just watch other people play and you can learn as you observe this game. So given what you know, would you play this game?
I don't know yet. We'll put it that way.
Okay. So let's say that you sit in the parking lot and you watch somebody else playing the game, right? And so round one, you notice that I pull out a green marble, okay? And so far, you've noticed that 100% of all of the marbles that you've seen me take out are green, okay? And the player's score was increased by 1.1%, mm-hmm. Okay? It's a favorable outcome. So far, no red marbles have been pulled. So do you know enough to say whether or not you want to play this game?
No.
Right. It's like observing somebody winning the lottery and saying, oh, that guarantees that I should be playing the lottery, right? Mm-hmm. So let's say that you start watching more rounds of the game. So let's go to round two. Okay. Round two comes up, and now I pull a red marble out. And you observe that the person who was playing basically lost 1% of the wealth that they had on the table. Okay. And so far, half of the marbles that I pulled out are green. Half of the marbles that I've pulled out are red. And the only thing that you really know for sure is that when a green marble is pulled out, wealth goes up 1.1%. When a red marble is pulled out, wealth goes down by 1%. But you still don't know the relative proportion of green and red marbles in that vat. So given what you know now, do you play?
Sample size still isn't big enough.
Sample size still isn't big enough. Let's let you play some more rounds. So I'm going to fast forward here to 10 rounds. So you watch 10 rounds. So out of 10 rounds, 6 green marbles have been pulled, 4 red marbles have been pulled. So each time a green marble was pulled, the wealth increased by 1.1%. Each time the red was pulled, it decreased by 1%. And you see that 60% of the marbles were green, 40% were red. And the total cumulative result is that the person who was staking their fortune on this game is now up to 102.6. So far, it's worked out for the person. Again, I'd ask you, do you want to play?
I'm definitely leaning towards it, but I'd still like a bigger sample size.
Okay. Let's go to 100 rounds then. Let's see what happens after 100 rounds. You're a very patient guy. You're willing to watch as 100 rounds are played and you're, you know, keeping your strict tallies each time of what happens.
I'm not a good gambler, Paul. So this is maybe biased against it.
Okay. Now notice, you know, this again is a random game. So the count of green marbles has now gone from 60 to 74. So it looks like the odds are actually better than what the past rounds would have indicated that they were. Mm-hmm. So there were 74 green marbles, 26 red marbles. And now the person who played, his score is now 173 versus your 100. So anybody, I think, waiting in the parking lot is going to feel their patience starting to be tested, right? I mean, this game is looking really good. The person who's playing it is obviously increasing their wealth. And so at some point, you're going to feel pressured. You're going to want to play because you're watching everybody else get rich. Meanwhile, you know, you're sitting in the parking lot and everybody who's playing is making fun of you for, you know, being off in the parking lot fondling your gold, right? So yeah.
I feel that my patience has not been rewarded in this case after seeing 100 rounds.
Okay, so let's say that you decide to play. But, you know, before we move on and play your rounds, let me just illustrate something for your viewers. And that is the odds that I picked here for this green and red game were essentially the same as the odds of being in the bond market. Mm-hmm. So this goes for 300 rounds. What I did was I took the recent historic return of the bond market leading up to 2014. And this is shown in white. And I overlaid the result of this random game where it was just a binary outcome, red or green, and we had fixed outcomes. Now notice how similar these curves are, right? The ultimate rate of return is about the same. The volatility is about the same. And if you were to put the marble game chart in front of somebody, they might actually think that this was generated from a real market, mm-hmm. right? When in fact, it Absolutely. Was only generated by this marble game that I made up. Mm-hmm. Right.
Paul, if just as an aside here, what, let's say, time period would each marble represent?
Oh, this would be a month.
Okay, perfect.
Okay. So let's move on to show that this can also be done for the stock market. Okay. So I put together a marble game that was very similar for the stock market. Now, this isn't the game that you're playing. You're just playing the bond market. Mm-hmm. In this case, I put 65% of green marbles in the vat with a 3.3% payoff each and 35% red marbles in with a 3.7% loss each time. Mm-hmm. So the expected return is 0.8% per play or 0.8% per month in the case of the stock market. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, I would have to actually do a lot of random generation exercises to get, you know, my marble game to look exactly the same as this white curve representing the stock market leading up to the year 2014. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the patience for that. So, you know, I played a few times and this one looks reasonably close. You'll notice that ultimately the total return was the same. A person who played for 300 months got the same result. And the volatility, you know, was fairly similar. Mm-hmm. It still has lots of ups and downs, lots of long-term ups and downs too. In fact, you might even take a look at this game and say, oh, you know, from 100 to 150, I would have been in that game, you know, because my technical analysis says, yeah, this is a favorable trend. I want to play this game. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as you and I both know, this was a marble game generating this outcome, right? So the question I guess I'd ask your readers is the stock market a random number generator? I kind of think that, yeah, there's a lot of fundamentals to it, but in a sense, because everybody's competitively bidding for these assets, prices for the most part reflect most of what people know. Mm-hmm. And so the movements in the stock market result largely from the things that have yet to come that people don't know and probably can't predict. So with that said, let's move on and play some marble games here. So let's say that you decide that you're going to sit down and you're going to play this marble game for 1,000 rounds. Here's what happens. Okay. You pull out 752 green marbles and 248 red marbles. So that's very close to the 75% green marbles that you could have inferred might have been in that vat from the 100 round game. Each time you gain 1.1% when a green marble is pulled, each time a red marble is pulled, you lose 1%. And so, you know, you're playing and your score has gone from 100, which is what everyone in the parking lot is experiencing, to 30,931. And you're feeling pretty smart. And everyone in the parking lot is feeling pretty dumb, right? So do you push your luck? Do you want to play again? Yeah, I mean, the odds are in your favor, right?
Absolutely. After 1,000 rounds, I feel pretty confident.
Absolutely. Okay. So these are the odds according to what you've observed so far. And then I pull out a black marble. And you're sitting there scratching your head like, what the heck? What's that? You know, I haven't seen that before. You know, I've been playing this for 1,000 rounds. I've been watching other people play for 100 rounds. And nobody said that there was a black marble in there. And that's right. I never said that there was a black marble in there. You deduced the odds of the game simply from what you were able to observe. Same goes for the bond market and the stock market, right? So I pull out this black marble and I start erasing your score. And you look at this in horror as I do this. And I change your score to zero. And then I pick somebody in the parking lot and I go off and I give them your score. So now the person who was in the parking lot, who had a score of 100, who was feeling pretty dumb and getting made fun of for sitting there fondling their safe assets, now has 30,931. And what this illustrates is there are catastrophes that happen periodically in the financial system. And we need to admit that those can happen. Now, nobody's going to be able to predict ahead of time when they will happen, right? But a lot of rich families know that there's a black marble in that vault. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why they own choice land, art, right? Fine furniture, and gold. Because when the absolute catastrophes have happened, the gold, fine art, fine land, and furniture and other antiques have carried the wealth of those wealthy families through the catastrophe over to the other side and allowed them to actually build wealth by buying the assets that everyone else is selling on a fire sale. Now, you and I, we can't own most of the assets that the wealthy own. You know, I mean, we can't afford the same kind of art. We can't afford the same kind of furniture or antiques. You know, the type of land that they own is inaccessible to us. Can we own a castle? No, absolutely not. Gold is one of the only things that we can own that's of the same quality as what the rich families own to preserve their wealth. And it's perfect because we can own it in small quantities. You know, you can't buy a Mona Lisa with what you have in your pocket, but you can probably go out and buy an ounce of gold. And it will be exactly the same quality as what the rich own. And another thing to know is that when you buy in small quantities, you're not moving the market. You know, when these rich families and governments buy gold, they buy it in such quantities that it's going to get noticed and it's going to move prices. Mm-hmm. Now, this is something that the Saudis actually knew because back in the 1970s, remember that currency crisis I was talking about? Well, one of the reasons why it happened was because the OPEC nations lost faith in the U.S. government, and they started taking the currency that was flowing into them from their sales of oil and trying to bid for gold directly, which is one of the reasons why gold skyrocketed in the late 1970s. You just cannot bid for gold in size, mm-hmm. which is why a lot of them right now are buying gold through the futures market. But you know, this game illustrates the nature of, you know, financial catastrophe. It only happens once in a very long time. You're not going to see it coming. You have to insure yourself for it.
So after doing all of this analysis, Paul, and now we understand, let's say, the importance of protecting against this black marble or black swan, you've also transferred this into the real world by taking the time to analyze the optimal blend of portfolios and how to spend your, let's say, your retirement at a sustainable pace, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right. You know, the other lesson that I would like to say about this is, you know, you probably don't want to be 100% metals, mm-hmm. unless you have a strong conviction that the metals prices are absolutely going to explode and you're going to be willing to live with yourself if they don't. Okay. You can do fairly well owning just a little bit of gold. Remember that 4-to-5-to-1 ratio that I was talking about at the beginning of this interview? Mm-hmm. Well, think about that. If there's an absolute financial catastrophe, if you hold 20-25% of your wealth in gold, that'll keep you whole. Mm-hmm. You know, meanwhile, you can take the rest of your assets and play this marble game, whether it's the stock market or the bond market. You can achieve a cash flow that can help you retire early and live off of the income that you generate. Meanwhile, you're protecting yourself against that black marble being pulled. Mm-hmm. So let me move on to another slide that that I have here that discusses why I believe that there is a really good mix of gold and stocks that you could adopt. So, you know, many decades ago, Bill Bengen did a study on safe withdrawal rates. And, you know, he took a look, I believe he was looking at a 50-50 stock and bond allocation. And what he concluded was that for a 30-year time horizon, you would have a better than 90% chance of surviving a 30-year retirement if you withdrew from that only 4% to start and gradually adjusted it for cost of living going forward. Trinity College did another study several years after where they had concluded that, yes, in fact, Bengen is correct, but they had also taken a look at different holding periods and different allocations. Now, I took a very, very careful look at that. And one thing that I found was that you could do pretty well, assuming a random walk, if you mixed gold and stocks and compare it to the stock bond allocation. So this is basically several decades worth of data. You'll see this blue curve right here represents the failure rate if you start withdrawing a certain amount from your portfolio each year for 30 years. And you'll notice that for 4% withdrawal rates, you're somewhere between a 4-5% failure rate, meaning that you would run out of money before you reach the end of that 35-year time horizon. Mm-hmm. Now, if you take a look at a couple, you know, allocations that consist of gold and stock, one thing that you'll notice is that they're pretty much right on top of the stock and bond allocation. Now, this is a good outcome, but unfortunately, it's flawed. And the reason why it's flawed is that what Bengen did was, and what Trinity also did, was they assumed that we had a bunch of independent 30-year time windows from, I believe he used 1928 through the present. I could be wrong on that starting year. So where I think Bengen and Trinity got it wrong was they had a number of decades worth of data, but only a few independent 30-year time windows. Okay, so they were essentially playing the marble game two or three times and making conclusions based upon that. Now, I think a lot of other researchers recognize the hole in their logic. And so what they do is they kind of patch the hole with something called Monte Carlo analysis. So they take a look at yearly return data, and they assume that the volatility of that data and the average return will persist into the future. And they do what's called a random walk, where what that means is that future outcomes are not dependent upon past outcomes. Okay, so you remember that marble game that we played? Mm-hmm. That was the same thing. Future outcomes were not dependent upon past outcomes. If I had drawn marbles from that vat and not replaced them, then future outcomes would have been dependent upon past outcomes. But anyway, that's just a technicality. So I think they got it wrong. And the reason why they got it wrong is because if I were to take a look at one-year time chunks, let me go to my next slide here. Okay, so where the Monte Carlo analysis is flawed is that it's assuming that all future outcomes are independent of past outcomes. And one thing that I've done in my work is that I've noticed that when you take a look at the correlation of paper asset returns, namely bond returns, and stock returns. Correlation actually grows the longer you hold them. Now, conversely, if you take a look at gold versus stocks and bonds, the longer you hold a mix of gold and stocks or a mix of gold with bonds, the more they tend to be anti-correlated. So with the correlation changing over time, that negates the validity of Monte Carlo. And I believe that this is a major finding and one that I've published in my videos. Maybe I'll make a book on it. I think I might. Anyway, let's go on to my next slide. Okay. So now let's take a look at risk versus return from 1971 through the year 2020. I'm picking the year 1971, not because it's going to favor gold, but because it is, I believe, the only point in time where afterwards we have consistent financial data. Because remember, in 1971, Nixon completely changed the definition of the currency, and thus he completely changed the definition of bonds. Before 1971, bonds and currencies were kind of a proxy for gold. And so mixing data before 1971 and data after 1971, I think personally, is pretty dangerous. And if we start with 1971, we get the longest string of potential data that we can learn from in modern history. So what I'm showing right here is on the x-axis, I'm using as variability a deviation around a trend line return. Now, what the heck do I mean by that? What I mean is that if I were to start precisely at 1971 and calculate returns out to 2020, I would get one result. If I started with 1974, I would get a completely different result. Now, to alleviate the problem of that time dependence, what I did was I took a look at the logarithm of the data and fit a line to it so that I could calculate the average or the average geometric rate of return over a particular time period that would be largely independent of starting time and ending time. Because I am sensitive to the start time being 1971. Now, the deviation around it means that if I have that model, and I see the actual returns, they're going to vary around that. So the distance that that actual return ends up being from the model gives me an idea of how predictable the asset mix is going to be over time in terms of return. So this x-axis is really the predictability of the returns that you would get from a mix of assets. Right? Now on the vertical axis here, I have the calculated annual real return. Now, this real return is adjusted for CPI reported price escalation. And you'll notice that I have many, many curves here. And this is for different mixes of stocks, bonds, and gold. This blue dashed line is the familiar one that we all see, where we have 100% stocks giving us the highest level of risk, that is the distance on the
X-axis. Highest probability of failure.
With the highest rate of return, here close to 7% on average. As we add 10% increment in bonds, you'll notice that the predictability gets better, right? But the return obviously gets worse, right? And so most people would say that, yeah, you probably want to be right around here. This is the traditional 10, 20, 30, 40% bond, 60% stock portfolio. And this gives you a predictability, that is the deviation of, around the trend line, of about 5%, and an average annual rate of return on an inflation-adjusted basis of 6%. Now, look what happens when we add gold, right? Here's one of my favorite portfolios right here. This is what happens if you have 35% gold and 65% stock. Now, notice you get very similar returns to the 60-40 portfolio that everybody likes, but it's a heck of a lot more predictable, right? So the conclusions that we can draw about the safe withdrawal rate would tell you that you could probably withdraw a lot more from a stock and gold portfolio and be comfortable doing that because you have better predictability of the future.
So Paul, when we're looking at the 65% stock allocation in that, you know, that model, are we just looking at, let's say, holding a couple index funds or you know, what are you considering stock in that case?
This is just the S&P 500 index.
Okay, perfect. So and then
plain vanilla.
And we're looking at physical gold.
Physical gold. Yep.
Okay.
Of course, I am eliminating taxes. Right. I'm eliminating transaction costs for gold and for stock. I mean, they're there. Mm-hmm. But everybody's situation is different, so it's impossible to include those. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me move on to my next slide. And you can see practically what this does for you, or what it could have done for you from, you know, in this case, I started in 1968, but you can see that you could have started in 1971 and got the same result anyway. It says, okay, if you start with 100 units of wealth in 1971, and you were to adopt different mixes of either bond and stock, or just stock, or, you know, gold and stock, here are the trends that you can see. Now, this black curve right here is just pure stocks. And you can see that we had the disastrous decade of the 1970s. We again had a pretty bad decade from 2000 to 2010. We had a couple of really good decades from 1980 to 2000. So the person who chose to put their wealth in stock did really well then. And for the past 10 years, stockholders did pretty well also, right? But they're not going to know ahead of time when the best time to be in stocks is. It is. Mm-hmm. It's very, very difficult. Right? Mm-hmm. Now, the chicken-hearted of us might say, okay, well, let's put our money into bonds. Right? You know how much you're getting back when you hold a bond to maturity. Let's see what happened with the bondholders here. Right? So here we had, again, a disastrous decade in the 1980s. Right? Mm-hmm. The person lost wealth. Now, most bondholders would say, no, that's ridiculous. I held to maturity each time. You know, my wealth is going to go up. But you're getting dollars back, right? You're getting these physical Federal Reserve notes that, you know, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing is creating all the time. And so your wealth is actually going down because prices are going up. Mm-hmm. So you had a disastrous decade in the 1970s. Again, you had a pretty good couple decades from 1980 through 2000 as interest rates went down. And then, you know, your rates of return started to decrease and decrease as interest rates went down. So how are you going to feel as a person who retires in 1971 if you own a 40% bond, 60% stock portfolio? Well, let's take a look at the trace. Both stocks and bonds had a pretty bad bad decade, mm-hmm. even though you know, overall, nominally, they did okay, but you still lost wealth each and every year the longer you held. And in the meantime, you're withdrawing from your portfolio. You're going to be feeling pretty bad by 1980, and you're not going to have the same standard of living as you did, you know, heading into retirement. Mm-hmm. Well, what happens if a person, you know, were to hold pure gold? Well, they had a great, great time in the 1970s. Right. I mean, they were living large. They were bragging. They felt pretty good. And then the 1980s and 1990s came along and gold didn't do so well. Mm-hmm. Right. And then we had a very good decade in 2000 to 2010 and not such a great decade, mainly because of what happened from 2011 to 2015 over the past decade. Right. But notice that the decades that financial assets did poorly in, gold did pretty well in. Mm-hmm. So this would suggest, again, that we just mix, you know, a little bit of gold, in this case, 35% is what I picked, with 65% stock. Let's see how that did. And that's the blue trace right here. And you'll see that consistently, you're doing pretty well, decade after decade, right? Mm-hmm. It's fairly consistent. And it's that predictability that I think is oh so important. I mean, you did just as well as stocks over five decades. You had some decades where you did worse than stocks, right? Like in the 1980s and 90s. You had some decades where you did worse than gold. But overall, you were pretty successful in each and every decade. And that variability is very important to somebody who's living off of their income.
So it's just this negative correlation that ends up working so well between gold and the stock, right?
That's right. And it's a negative correlation that grows. And let me go to that.
Okay.
For the sake of time, I'm just going to skip this chart. And let's go to this chart right here. So here's the correlation coefficient. Now, let me, for the sake of your viewers, tell them what a correlation coefficient is. Okay. If the correlation coefficient is 100 on the positive side, it means that moves in one asset perfectly correlate with moves in another asset. It doesn't mean that they have to move to the same amount, but they always have to move in the same relative amount and in the same direction.
Right.
If the correlation coefficient is 100% to the negative, it means that they're perfectly anti-correlated, meaning that they're always going to move in opposite directions. Now, does having a negative correlation coefficient mean that if you hold an equal amount of each asset, you're going to have a zero return? And the answer is no, right? If gold always has, an average constant positive return, and stocks always have a constant positive return, then holding a blend of them simply means that over time, you should always have a positive return. What it means with a negative correlation is that when stocks are doing better than their average, gold will be doing worse than its average. And when stocks are doing worse than their average, gold will be doing better than its average. So the one tends to correct for deficiencies in the other.
Right.
So as a consequence, you're always going to feel a little bit good and a little bit bad by holding a mix. Right. Now, if we look at single months worth of holding time, you'll notice if we look at stocks and bonds, they have a correlation coefficient, at least over the time period that I looked at, of between 30 and 40%, meaning that they're not very correlated, but they're still somewhat correlated. And this is what modern finance uses as the justification for holding a blend of bonds with your stocks. It reduces volatility. Gold, when we take a look at them compared to both bonds and stocks, have almost a zero degree of correlation, meaning, if stocks or bonds move in one direction, you have absolutely no idea what gold's going to do on a month-to-month basis. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fair.
Yep.
But now, if you hold them without rebalancing over, let's say, a longer period of time, notice what happens. The correlation coefficient between bonds and stocks actually grows. So what this tells you is that if you hold a mix of bonds and stocks, you better be rebalancing all the time. The more frequently you do it, the better. And if you don't, if you let it ride for, let's say, 5 years and then come back to it, then if bonds do poorly, chances are your stocks did poorly too. And it's going to result in you suffering. On the other hand, if you take a look at gold, if you hold a pile of gold separate from your stocks and you hold it for, let's say, 5 years, notice that the degree of anti-correlation grows, right? Out of 5 years, the degree of anti-correlation between stocks and gold is, much better than 50%. It's like approaching 70%. Mm-hmm. And between gold and bonds is about minus 50%. And as you get out to, 6 years to 8 years, the correlation coefficient between gold and stocks drops to, negative 80%. And that's pretty powerful. And what this tells you is that if you gradually rebalance and don't like rebalance every month, rebalance every year, but maybe do a partial rebalance every year, you're going to do pretty well with that 35% gold, 65% stock portfolio, as the data would suggest.
So, Paul, as we think about, let's say, the stock side of this equation, do you think if you set up some rules to, really put this into the real world application, if you set up a rule, let's say, that if you lost 8% of your portfolio on the stock side, to sell that and then buy back in, let's say, when it has leveled off or started to pick back up, have you put any thought towards having, in a way, a trailing stop like that to protect some of that capital?
Well, kind of. I, in the hypothetical world where costs don't matter and taxes don't matter, mm-hmm. it looks like the optimum, at least from what I could tell, is to rebalance a third of the way every year. That seems to be about the optimum. So if you have a bad year in stocks, you might calculate what your target is and move a third of the way there at the end of each year. Mm-hmm. And theoretically, that's great. Practically, it sucks. I mean, it's bad. And the reason is that it requires very large transactions. And once your wealth grows beyond a certain point, a lot of your wealth is going to be eaten in transaction costs and taxes, mm-hmm. right? Especially if your preference is for physical metals, because there is a spread for both metals. I mean, it used to be that you could pay a spread of 3 or 4% for a gold eagle. That's much higher now, but those spreads are important. And I do recommend that people report their taxes, because you don't want the IRS against you. Now let's move into the real world, where costs matter and taxes matter. Most of us are going to be in one or two phases in our lives. Either we're going to be accumulating assets, or we're going to be living off of those assets, mm-hmm. which means that we're constantly making adjustments anyway, right? We're constantly either putting money in or withdrawing it. So if your goal is to make a slow rebalance, the most practical way to do that is when you have new money, put it in the asset that's below its target. As you're distributing your funds and living off of it in retirement, when you have to sell something, sell the asset that's above its target. And that will accomplish your gradual reallocation. Mm-hmm.
So a great way of thinking about this model is just that it takes out the complicated nature of looking at this stuff, let's say every day, worrying about it every day. And instead, it's like in a way, it's a set and forget simpler way of analyzing how these markets behave, and in a way hedging for these black marble events, so that you have a consistent nest egg, if you want to call it that, at the end of the day.
That's right. And thinking about this chart a little bit further, one can quickly conclude that if the correlation actually grows over time, the negative correlation grows over time, you don't want to be constantly rebalancing. I mean, stocks, if you take a look at stocks relative to gold, if they have a couple good years, chances are they're going to continue to have a few more good years. If they have a couple bad years, chances are they're going to have, another few bad years. So if you're rebalancing every year, you're sacrificing your gold or sacrificing your stocks unnecessarily, mm-hmm. right? The idea is to wait for it to play out a little bit more, and only rebalance gradually. And that will benefit you not only mathematically, but it'll also reduce your costs and your taxes. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Is there anything else on for these slides that you want to go through, Paul?
No, I don't think so. We've been going for a while. I think it probably exhausted many of your subscribers' patience.
Well, we want to be sensitive to attention spans. And I really appreciate your time and you being able to share this with our audience, Paul. It's really great to be able to look at the data in this way, that, you really take the time to go through and figure out how all of this stuff works. There's many more videos on your YouTube channel that are excellent. Maybe we can make another time to go through is, the inflation adjusted price of gold right now, things like that. Even the way that it makes up for the money in circulation. There's all kinds of videos like that you have. Why don't you tell our viewers what change you've recently made to your channel, so that they can get an idea of where you're heading?
Okay, sure. Well, first of all, I changed the name. I changed it from Blank P to Evidence-Based Wealth. And I did that because a lot of people were recommending that I do it, because Blank P is kind of obscure. And it is an obscure channel. Right now I have 18,000 and 19,000 subscribers, so it's not a lot. But I tell you, the quality of the people that subscribe are great. So that was one change. The other change that I made was you know, I have some time now available to me to do a better job of conveying the information that I'd like to convey. Videos are an imperfect form of doing that. I mean, some people learn very well from videos, but I bet a lot of people, you know, who are watching are going to need to go through, you know, this video itself several times if they really want to understand what's being presented. And such is the case with a lot of the videos that I've put out. I've had subscribers tell me they've had to go back and watch something four or five times to really get it. And even then they didn't truly understand it. So what I've been wanting to do was go to a written format where I put out reports and also have, you know, some discussions with people interactively. And so, this is going to require quite a bit of time on my part. So I decided to open a Patreon account. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I did that is that, you know, I'm not looking to generate a lot of income. I'm looking to generate, you know, only enough to compensate me for the time that I'm putting in, you know, so that I can avoid spending my time doing other things to supplement my income, like, you know, teach chemical engineering or whatnot. But the other thing that Patreon does is, you know, it will help to fund some of the research that's necessary to put together the videos that I put out on YouTube. So I plan on continuing to put those out because I really do think that, you know, it's a valuable service to provide to people to give them insight into the financial world and some guidance into things that they can do personally to build and protect their wealth. And I'd rather not take that away from the people that can't afford to pay for such a service. So it seems like, you know, doing a Patreon is a good way to achieve all the goals that I have. I also started writing a book, a couple chapters into it, and I anticipate being able to publish by the end of this year. And the book is going to contain, you know, a lot of the things that I've discovered and refined over the past, you know, let's say 10 years worth of work.
Excellent, Paul. So where can we find your Patreon and any of your socials, let's say your channel and your socials?
Okay, well, anybody who's interested in the video sections can go to my YouTube channel. So if you search on YouTube for BELANGP, you'll find it. Mm-hmm. If you search for evidence-based wealth, you also find it. Unfortunately, you also find several hundred videos, so it may be tough to figure out where to start. I'll have to try to figure out a way to you know, put together a catalog of the most important videos at some point soon. But I think you'll probably enjoy each one of them if you give them a chance. Those who are interested in the Patreon can find me at www.patreon.com/BELANGP. So I've posted the first chapter of my book up there for the public, and I'm working on the first article that I'm going to release. One thing that I'd encourage people to be a little bit careful of, I found out that Patreon has a month-to-month billing cycle that's the first to the first for everybody. So if you sign up late in the month, chances are you're going to get billed twice. So if you're going to sign up, maybe wait until early in the month. Mm-hmm. But for this month, I turned off the billing for August the 1st. So anybody who's signing up late in July isn't going to get billed twice this time around.
Excellent. You also have a Twitter that you're not too active on, right, Paul?
Not really. I was playing around with it some. I wasn't even able to get BELANGP. Somebody else got it. So there I'm BELANGP1. Okay. But I'm not really tweeting on a regular basis.
Perfect. All right, Paul. Well, we really appreciate your time and the info that you shared with us today. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks, Tom. It was a pleasure. A lot of fun.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.